Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Upgrade your laundry routine with a durable and reliable Maytag laundry pair at Lowe's. Like the new Maytag washer and dryer with performance-enhanced stain-fighting power designed to cut through serious dirt and grime. And what's great is this laundry pair is in stock and ready for delivery when you need it the most. Don't miss out. Shop Maytag in-store or online today at Lowe's.
Hi. Welcome along to another episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Thank you so much for your company. I really appreciate it, and it's wonderful to have you with us on our journey into sound, stereophonic sound. Well, it's a journey into sound and how it's used in film and telling stories, basically, if you are joining us for the first time. It's basically what it's about. It's beautiful, gorgeous relationship between music and film that you can't put your finger on because it kind of affects you from the inside out. Very excited about today's episode, but just quickly, next week you are going to hear from the fabulous Kevin McDonald, who is an extraordinary director who's been on the podcast a couple of times before. I think the last time he was on was for The Mauritanian, which is a fantastic film. Anyway, Kevin's made this quite exquisite and emotional and very entertaining documentary about John Lennon and Yoko Ono. Now, it's hitting cinemas, but it's coming out before cinemas on IMAX Special on the 9th and 10th of April. So that's this coming week. So I just wanted to highlight that because you should definitely, if you can, get along and see it. So if you want to find out details about where you can see it on IMAX, because it's going to be a limited release on IMAX, but it's one of those films that what they've done with the music as well is pretty extraordinary. So you know how that Beatles new track came about with this amazing technology that Peter Jackson's kind of team created, where they were able to pull out John Lennon's voice from these old demos. They've used that same sort of mechanism on how the music is kind of produced and mixed on this. And Sean Lennon's been very much part of that journey. So if you can, 9th and 10th of April is when it is on IMAX. And if you want to find out details, 121film.com. That's 121film.com. One obviously being the word one. So 121film.com is where you want to head to find out more details. It's brilliant. It really is. And I'm looking forward to sharing that chat with Kevin, the director. It's that thing where you think you know everything about John Lennon. This film, well, we'll correct that because you don't. And it's quite revelatory, actually. And excited to share our chat next week. But let's talk about this week because I'm very excited about this episode. And I can't quite believe what we're sharing with you today, as no fewer than eight people are involved. Nine, if you include me, in Apple's brilliant, brilliant, mind-bending Let's Talk About It at the Water Cooler show, Severance. So a load of them joined me on stage in front of an audience as part of our Everyman Soundtracking Film Club. This is something that we've run for over a year now, and we're really proud of what we've done, the stories that we've brought to a live audience, and also what we can and hope to do with it as well. We're going to set up a mailing list for Soundtracking, and within that, that will give you details. We'll send out emails to you guys once we know what dates we've got new events on and how you can get tickets and stuff. So look out on our socials for details on that mailing list. We'll get that up in the next week or so as well. I don't really know what to say about the show, to be honest, apart from it is like nothing else you've ever seen. It's mind-bending, it's entertaining, it's funny. Music clearly has such a big part to play in the show and for the characters as well. And as well as this huge panel that we had at one of our Everyman Film Club events, I also got a few minutes separately with one of the main men behind it. He's been with it from the start, executive producer and directed so many episodes, Ben Stiller, to discuss the music in a bit more detail. But Before we bring you that, let's enjoy the conversation that I had with Ben, Gwendolyn Christie, Deechan Lachman, Tramell Tillman, Zach Cherry, Britt Lauer, Adam Scott, and the show creator, Dan Erickson, where we had a lovely chat at our live event at Everyman King's Cross. I know. Severance is scored by, I always used to call him Theodore Shapiro, but you'll hear Ben correct me in our chat, but it's Teddy Shapiro, and we'll begin with his main titles. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Congratulations on this extraordinary. It looked so great on the big screen in here as well. So great to show it in theater. It's wonderful.
Yeah, so much fun to watch it. You know, we sort of always imagine it like a movie anyway.
Yeah.
So it was really
fun. Yeah, it's so cinematic. Dan, I'm going to start with you, if that's all right, please, sir.
All right.
What was the catalyst to this idea? Where did it come from? What story did you want to tell? And why did you want to tell it?
Well, I had this experience that I think is pretty unique to me, which is that I was working a job I hated. And found myself walking in. This was, I've said this a number of times, but it was a door factory. And I was working in a little office cataloging hinges and, you know, deadbolts and other door pieces. And I found myself walking in one day and thought, I don't want to do this anymore. And if I have to go in today, I would prefer to just skip ahead to the 8 hours and disassociate. And then the whole thing just kind of came from that.
Kind of whole thing came from that. It's this extraordinary, like, layered kind of production with these fantastic characters that we all love. In terms of the roadmap, though, that you set out in your head in terms of what you wanted, where you saw this story going, so interested in terms of what that roadmap was and how many kind of rogue little roads have taken you on different journeys throughout that path.
That's the thing, is that as I thought about the idea, and especially once Ben came on, you know, we wanted to be sure that it was about more than just this kind of idea that we're different people at work and versus at home, or that we don't like work. And what we realized is that, you know, the show is very much about sort of identity and who we are at our core. And if we would be the same people without our memories, if we had existed in a, you know, grown up or lived in a totally different scenario. Mm. And then also just the way that in a corporate setting, we can have our humanity sort of diminished, and in some cases kind of willingly diminish our own humanity so that we can fit into that setting, and what the dangers are of that.
Ben, what was the appeal for you when you first spoke and met with Dan about being involved in the way that you are specifically with the show?
Yeah, I mean, it was a great script. It was, you know, it came through to our production company as a spec script. And you don't really read that many things that just come in out of the blue and go, oh my God, this is great. Sometimes, though, like when it's a spec script, you go, oh, it's a spec script. Why isn't anybody making this? So that was the first thing I asked Jackie Cohn, who's at our company, who read it and loved it. And she said, I don't know what's going on. We should meet with Dan. And I think you took a break from working DoorDash or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I had gone from the door factory to DoorDash.
Yeah. It's a bit like Screwfix here. We've got a place called Screwfix in the UK.
Screwfix.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds kind of similar.
I like Screwfix better.
Yeah, that's better.
Hinges and deadbolts, Screwfix.
Do they fix things with screws, or do they fix your screws?
Both. It's whatever you go in with, Adam. They're there to help whatever
it's
the screw is
like
that needs
fixed. It's
kind
of like a Home Depot, but like they deliver.
They're all getting the shout-outs today.
Nice.
It's amazing.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Sponsored to you by Screwfix.
B&Q and Homebase.
Anyway, yeah, yeah. So no, it was just, it had so much in it tonally. It had this humor in it in the first episode, which has changed a little bit from what, you know, it was in the original script. But this also, I think there was just so many different things going on in it. You know, what Dan talked about, there's also just the aspect of, you know, what Mark is going through, the loss that he's going through and grief. And I think, you know, losing someone and death and how do you reconcile that? And then, you know, I think that became an important theme in the show because it's about pain and, sort of the idea of, you know, how do you, you know, stop yourself from feeling pain? And then the sort of question of like, should we stop ourselves from feeling pain? How do you deaden pain? If you suppress it, then you're, it's still there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so that all those elements to it are I think were what interested me, but it was just like so unique tonally and it got me excited thinking about it just like, and I you know, wanted to connect with Dan on it. And then we had a you know, that was what, like, I don't know, like 8 years ago or something.
Wow.
This was, yeah, early 1991, I think.
Dan was, yeah, and then it was like a long process, you know. Apple didn't even exist, I think, when we, Apple TV Plus didn't exist.
Yeah, Apple existed.
Yeah.
Adam, congratulations on, you know, on this character over these two seasons that we've watched. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that idea that, you know, these two versions of this one man and playing that, but then also playing how those two versions grow and change and develop and learn things about each other themselves. There's so many kind of fine details that you have to really walk a tightrope with in terms of what they're telling each other, what they're telling us as audience, what they're telling other characters. How do you play something like that?
Yeah, I think that was one of the many things that appealed to me when Ben called me in like January of 2017 and told me the like three sentence kind of pitch of what the show is, you know, and I was immediately hooked. I didn't read a script for another year or so, but just the idea of it, I couldn't shake. I couldn't get out of my head. It was almost like one of those ideas that's so good you can't believe someone hadn't already done it. It's just so simple and perfect and good. And then I read the script and Dan had fleshed it all out with all these incredible characters and arcs and stuff. And yeah, so for, you know, Mark, both the innie and the outie, they're both going through different things, and obviously. But I think that particularly in season two, the interesting thing was they kind of start out with similar interests. Mm-hmm. And Innie Mark is on board with Outie Mark and what he needs. And he's almost, he almost wants to make sure that Gemma gets out, almost as a need that he feels for his Outie. He feels entirely for his Outie and it kind of feels almost subservient, almost like I need to do this for him. But then as the season goes on and, you know, the innies in season two, we keep saying that it's almost like they're going through adolescence of some sort and like their teenage years or rebellious years. And so their interests start to diverge a bit as the season goes on. And that sort of sets them on a bit of a collision course. Just thought that was a fascinating direction to go.
And in particular in this, you know, in this season, when we see that incredible scene in the episode where you're playing against the innies, you know, that scene with the innie versus the outie, and just in terms of how your state of mind as an actor in terms of trying to play those two characters, having that conversation with each other, what was the kind of reality of shooting that and how you did that?
Well, by far, it was the most difficult actor I've ever worked with. I now know what all of my lovely co-stars have been dealing with
Which
for
one?
5 years.
Yeah. Which one?
They're both impossible.
It was rough.
You refused to do off camera for yourself.
I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't
that
make
I've
eye
moved
contact.
Down the rankings of most difficult actor. That
That's right.
I've
That's
worked.
Right. I supplanted Zach. Yeah, it was very challenging, but really fun. And you know, I just know how lucky I am that I had Dan and Bo Williman and Mark Friedman working on this scene as writers and Ben directing and Ben and Jeff editing. I mean, it was a real team effort. And you know, it was a big steep climb and a challenge, but it was super fun.
Yeah, the editing on that, Ben, is extraordinary.
Yeah, that's Jeff Richman, our editor, who's edited all the episodes with, along with a few other editors. And, you know, the only thing I'd say about that scene is when we started putting it together, I was concerned at the beginning, oh, this is like, you know, a long scene. I knew Adam had done a great job, but just for an audience, it's a lot to watch. And but every time we would watch it from the beginning, Jeff and I would always get drawn into what was the scene, you know, that what was being said. And I think that what felt to me like I was like, all right, if I'm getting drawn into this, you know, hopefully the audience will too. But I think it's similar to maybe the first season's finale, where there are a lot of threads that come together for the audience, which is why I think, you know, it can be it's satisfying for a lot of people as a finale for the first season. I think in the same way, the writing of what, you know, the situation that Dan created, and it leads to this point where you really want to see these two people talk to each other.
Brett, I just love watching you play these characters. It's just absolutely, your kind of empathy and sympathy shifts so much kind of, you know, with them, with her. And I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about kind of getting to that point where you can't give too much away to an audience. But then also for you, reading a script, do you always get the entire season on script, or do you want to know kind of, you know, that journey, or do you kind of stay in that moment as to where the character is at that time for what you're about to shoot?
I guess in this moment, I'm thinking about season one and meeting Helly R in Dan's pilot when I read it for the first time, and just falling in love with her and how she moves through the world. And then flash forwarding to the first time we see Helena speaking to Helly and telling her that she's not a person and that she has no right to make a decision. And it's this moment where you realize these are two parts of the same person waging a war inside of herself. And that war continues in season two. But I think they start to kind of, like Adam's characters, start to learn, and all of the innies and outies start to learn a little bit more about each other through having literally stepped into each other's shoes. And that was a really fun 5D chess game to get to play that Dan wrote.
What's her motivation?
Which one?
Both.
Well, there are so many. But I think there's a longing for connection for the innies and the outies. I think I learned a lot about Helena this season and how isolated she is within the same company, within this family. And so these two parts of the same person are trapped, but in really different ways.
Yeah. Zach, Dylan kind of, I love how he became a bit of a hero in this season. I kind of love that strength that we kind of see really develop in him, particularly in the innie, on both of them, really. At some points, they both kind of like find strength in whatever situation they're thrown at. Where is he finding that strength from, do you think?
I don't know. I should say, I mentioned her earlier, I'm the most jet-lagged I've ever been in my life.
So, I'm here for you.
This will be stream of consciousness.
We can answer your questions for you.
Yeah, so pretty much whatever Ben was about to say. No, I mean, I think a lot of it comes from connection, like Britt was saying. Yeah. You know, the innie, especially in season one, he starts off kind of a little selfish, and he's not that close to the people in the office. He's a little antagonistic. And then we watch him make these meaningful connections over the course of season one. And then in season two, he gets this completely different type of connection that kind of takes him away from them. But then at the end of the season, he's kind of brought back to them via his connection to his family and everything. So I think it really is just from his connection to others.
I also like kind of how he's gone from being so irate and kind of fearful of the different departments, and now he's kind of craving them in a way as well, in terms of it's kind of like that, it's that connection, I guess, in a way as well.
Yeah, I think he's learned that his life is better with people like in his on his team.
Tramiel, the maraca, excellent choice. I mean, I could just watch 10 episodes of you dancing and just, you know, choreography and merriment. It's just, we all need more of that in life. But what a fascinating character. You know, in terms of what I love about watching you play him is that there are moments where we see a little crack. There are moments where we think suddenly, oh, he's gonna turn. He's on their side. And then you go, shit, he's really not. He's gone completely the other way. how much fun do you have with that in terms of that kind of stoic physical kind of presence that gets to let loose every now and again, that gets to kind of tease everybody in the way that you do?
You know, there's a weight that Milchick carries daily, you know, and it's fun as an actor to step into it, but it's tiring after 12, 14 yeah. hours, you know. But what's so invigorating about this character is that this man, I see him as a bit of a clown, you know? Like, he has this task of keeping everyone else on task, and he fails every single time. But damn it, he keeps going. He just keeps showing up, you know? And I really admire that tenacity. Me too.
Totally. Me too.
He doesn't like being an actor. Yeah. Yeah.
Could you mind talking a little bit about that, the scene, you know, where we choreographed merriment, and am I right in thinking that you surprised them all with having disco lights, that you guys didn't know there was going to be disco lights flashing?
On the first season, for the music dance experience, we tried to keep it a secret from everybody.
We're like, whoa, yeah. We are yeah. not
total
acting.
That was
real. That was real.
Why?
I was not impressed.
You know, you talk about Tramiel's dancing, but Adam's dancing is pretty amazing.
It's very specific.
Thank you, Ben.
Do we have choreographers involved, or
yes,
is this just
it is very specific.
Purely from your soul?
Oh, I conceived that all on my own.
Yeah. All the choreographers quit the second he did that. They said,
I walked in.
We will not be a part of this.
The day Adam discovered his hips.
Yep.
But that gorgeous scene in, you know, the episode with the band with the majorettes and I mean, that's just. It's extraordinary.
Yeah,
it's
so
powerful.
Yeah, it was just an out of the blue idea that we thought would, you know, make sense for how they might want to take it over the top for completing the 100, you know, Cold Harbor is an important file. And Tramiel just has this ability to dance that I do not, and most people do not. But he really just kind of like, I don't know, like, how did you, because you got with our band sort of director, and then you just kind of, how did that happen?
Yeah, so, you know, he taught me the basics. He taught me how to direct, right? So I wanted to make sure that Milchick knew what he was doing. Uh-huh. So that was part of it. But then the next part, that next song, you know, that was really a collaborative moment of how Milchick can infuse another, you know, another part of himself into this. You know, we get to see a lot of his joy and a lot of his frivolity, you know, when you see the ballad of Gunnell and Ambrose, and he just lets loose, you know, and he's having a great time, and then Helly comes in and takes his phone and locks him in a bathroom. So it's just, again, fails.
I just want to see what he's doing outside of work, really.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Deechan, this is such a beautiful performance, you know, this character, and particularly where we get to, you know, with that episode where we get to see what she's going through and what her kind of existence is and all those kind of different scenarios. And they know her because all those scenarios have a connection to Gemma in some way, shape or form, her story. How was that for you kind of having to take that character through all those kind of scenarios, you know, kind of almost like little short films, each one of them, really.
Just one step at a time with amazing leadership and an incredible crew. I mean, Gwendolyn, you talked about it in LA, just the attention to detail that went into designing the space and the character and the story of the hair and the costumes and making her feel so lived in. It felt like such a collaborative experience. And I don't know if I could have done it without like such a talented crew and committed, dedicated group of people. You just couldn't wish to work with better ones, really. But it was exciting for me to finally be in that space. I felt like I'd been waiting so long on the testing floor to get onto set and work with all these remarkable people. And it was scary, but I had incredible guidance.
And did you talk to Dan and Ben about what those kind of pull-throughs were for Gemma to the scenario that she finds herself in?
Do you mean how she got in there?
Well, no, how those each kind of those scenarios that she finds herself in has got some kind of connection through to you know, Gemma in the real world.
Oh, right. Yeah. Dan and Mark and everyone were always so open to sort of talking through the beats. And what was really fun, which you don't always get to do, I'm sure everyone can confirm, is in television, is we got to go to the house and we got to rehearse the scenes and even all the little rooms with a wonderful actor, Robbie Benson, who plays Dr. Mauer. We got to rehearse, and in those rehearsals, you know, you get to fine-tune those moments, which you don't always get the opportunity to do. And I think it was so, so valuable.
Is there ever a moment, Ben and Dan, where your cast kind of come to you with a question and you go, can't tell you. Do you know what I mean? In terms of, because it's where the character maybe is going, or it's something that they don't need to have information to yet.
I think that generally speaking, I like to give actors information if they ask for it, because each actor has a slightly different process in terms of how much they want to know, and especially if it's something the character wouldn't know at that moment. So I think that if any actor has ever come up to me and asked me for a piece of information, I say, I know it, but I don't want to tell you. I think that I'm lying. I think that's an instance where I just don't know the answer and won't admit it.
Gwendolyn, oh my God, it's brilliant watching you in this show. I mean, she's like one cross Heidi, one cross like Working Girl, or one cross Michael Douglas and Falling Down or something. It's brilliant. It's just so many. Wow. It's so fantastic.
Wow.
But it's great. But that's what that
dream combo.
It's, I mean, what's her outie like? It's just so many questions. Talk to me a little bit about, I mean, I know you were a fan, and so just kind of coming in to inhabit this role, but also very much bring you and, you know, your wonderful kind of capabilities to this character and bring her to life.
I was an absolutely enormous fan of the show. As soon as I saw it, it was one of those landmark moments, like when I saw Twin Peaks when I was 11 years old. And something is so original and singular, and it has such depth that it's entering your subconscious in a way you can't even comprehend and igniting your imagination. And so consequently, I assumed I would never be cast in it. And it was a real dream to become a part of the show. I've talked a lot about how the show was so exceptional to me that it made me angry that I wasn't part of it. So when I very fortunately received an email from Ben's producer asking if I'd be interested in being a part of the show, I sort of sank to my knees holding the phone aloft and weakly called out for aid to assist me in my enfeebled state. But it's just such an undeniably rich world, the likes of which we don't really see in television. And we don't really see it now, because what this is seized upon more than anything else, I think personally, is meaning and time. And so we start to really look at humanity in a way that's dismantled, because in our current society we do dismantle it, and because we do commodify it, and we do make it technological, and we measure it, and also we get this weird breath of the ephemeral coming through. It's really unlike anything I've ever watched, and I have a very different experience as a viewer watching it to really anything else at all. So no doubt over the moon to be lucky enough to be in it. And was a huge fan of the goats. I was watching the show on my own, 11 a.m. Friday morning. That's when I would watch
it.
Make sure everyone's out of the house. The dogs, they have to be quiet, or they have to leave the room. And they don't want to leave the room because they too are fans of the show. Anyway, it was that moment of hearing the cry of the goats, something else occurred. And of course, me and my particular interest that evokes the satanic and all sorts of, you know, my part-time hobbies. But it felt so radical and humorous that I really wanted to be involved with the goats. And that opened up a portal in a way that really not many things have creatively for me in a long time, in terms of wanting to, I knew this had to be about a sensual experience. So about something that I wasn't really that familiar with, a relationship with the land. and that invisible relationship with animals, and something that really matters, the degree of trauma where someone is compressed into only being really able to communicate with animals and not so much people, only a small group of people. And I love the idea of the destructive pressure of the corporate world deforming someone's character to the point that they're overtaken by they're transformed in a sort of animalistic way. And I'm fighting on screen again.
Kicking ass. Oh, my God. Yeah?
But it was delightful because it was about a violent psychic emotion and telling the story in a very particular physical way. It's been nothing but a real honor and a privilege to be involved.
It's all the production design as well was just breathtaking. Even like that kind of weird contraption that the lamb's in that, you know, in that moment, yeah. It's kind of like, it's beautiful, but it's like, oh shit, that's just about to happen. The rolling hills in the room kind of thing with the lambs. And there's just so much detail in there. Dan, how do you write that kind of level of detail? You know, in terms of, we all sit on, you know, Reddit and loads of other websites after we've watched the show for days afterwards talking about, did you see that? Three meant something. Or, you know, did you see that in the box, on the crib, all that kind of stuff. There's so much detail in there. Where do you start with that? Are you kind of going, I've got 10 layers here I want to write into the script? Or is it the other way around?
A lot of it comes from our great, you know, production team and designers and everybody. You know, there are things like the images that you see on that goat holder thing, which I had nothing to do with. You know, that just sort of I saw that in the design phase, and I said, okay, yeah, no notes, you know. But stuff like that enriches the world. It's like you can look at that and you can read into it kind of what the ceremony is and how long it's existed and why they do it. And so much of the storytelling is done that way. But you know, I also just have a really intrinsic trust in Ben and in the other people who have been brought on to tell the visual side of the story, because at this point all of them just get it. They just get it so well. And it's you know, we like to have as much communication as we can, but I feel like 9 times out of 10 it's me just looking at it and going, yeah, you nailed it. That's that's it.
How do you decide what episode you want to direct?
Oh, going out like into the snow seemed like it would be fun. You know, doing the finale, I knew it would be fun to do. You know, I mean, I guess I just try to go for, you know, there's the logistical part of it too.
Yeah.
And it's always kind of trying to figure it out. And I usually feel like, oh, I bit off more than I could chew, but it's also so tasty. You know, like it's so, like this group of people and this experience, it's really, you know, been my job for the last, you know, 5 years we've been working on it, and I've loved it. So I try to like think about it in terms of like what can I handle, and also, you know, like episode 8 with Patricia Arquette, I really love Patricia and thought that would be really fun to be able to work with her in that way. And then we have other, you know, Jessica Lee Gagne, I have to say, who directed episode 7 this season, the Deachin episode, the Gemma episode was so amazing. She's been our cinematographer. I've worked with her on other projects before. And, you know, everybody, it's what Dan was saying, everybody's so connected to this by this time, because everybody's been on it that long, that we really have like this collaborative thing where people will come in with ideas. Our prop master, production design, Jeremy Hindle, costume designer, Sarah Edwards, and our, you know, special effects guy, Doug Coleman, who like, you know, worked on, you know, creating the Kier statue to have it be a remote control and that, you know, I could control off camera, like fun things like that. There's so many of those things in the show that are, like Dan was saying, people bring them, and then we sort of like synthesize what, you know, what feels right in terms of those details. And then, you know, it's just like a you know, kind of everybody jumps in. We also don't shoot the show episode by episode. We do block shooting where we shoot, like we'll go to Lumen, the building in New Jersey, and we'll shoot for like a week there and do maybe parts of 3 episodes and things like that. So it's kind of, we shoot over a course of months, and then so every director is always around for a long time too. And we had a great director this season, Sam Donovan, who's from here, and Uda Breshowitz, who just did great work. And Yeah, and I just feel like so, you know, fortunate that the like the cast of the show is so good, and I feel not this isn't answering your question. I'm just talking now, but
it's good.
I just wanted
it's what
to
we're
say,
here for. It's fine.
Like I just like that fight sequence. You know, what's so great about it to me is that the emotion and the depth that are brought to it by the actors, so that that last moment where you're holding, you know, the gun on him, it's like I never in a million years imagined that being such an emotional moment. But this character who we haven't seen since episode 3 has a whole life and has, you can just, and you read it in what's going on with her and with Dari and Adam and, you know, John Turturro, who's not here, who's working in New York, you know, who just, they, and Chris Walken, they bring so much emotional reality to this crazy reality that, you know, Dan has created that is rooted in real things, but it's hard to believe if you don't believe the actors. So that I feel like that's the key to what allows an audience to believe it.
Yeah. Just quickly about Patricia. That's a great episode. Where was that? Where
we went to Newfoundland, a town called Bonavista.
Does it just look like that? Did you have to do much?
We made it look a little worse than. I mean, Newfoundland in the winter is cold.
Felt it. Yeah. You were like putting a jacket on to watch the show.
Yeah, it's actually a beautiful. I mean, it's a beautiful place. We had a great time there.
We actually went there several years before and introduced Ether to the community, in order to make it authentic.
That's the emotional
commitment.
Reality.
Wow.
You got to do it.
I've got so many questions that you probably can't and won't answer anyway, but like one of them is like, why is Cobalt Mark's neighbor?
I think that there's clearly a personal and or professional interest there.
Answering it? I didn't think you would actually answer it. Amazing.
Well, it's a little bit of a non-answer, but it's the best I can give is that there's clearly some, you know, need for her to be watching him, whether it comes from within or from Lumen.
When you went in to start filming season 2, were all the episodes written?
We had not finished writing all the episodes when we shot this time. We had figured everything out, but there were like we knew the plan, but there was some script work that we still had to get done.
Yeah, there's definitely like, you know, as we go along, there's always adjustments that are happening. And I think that's important to like leave room for that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're kind of having to adjust for what you're seeing as it's developing. And that's just an important part of the process, I think.
Yeah, I've said this in the scene where Mark is talking to himself. You know, there are shots in that where I swear you can hear me typing and rewriting off screen. I was trying to be quiet.
I've got to mention the music and your incredible theme, Theodore Shapiro. Did you know what you wanted it to sound like? Did you have an idea? Because it's kind of, you can't imagine the show without that.
No, we rely on the music heavily. I mean, there's a lot of score and it's because it's like almost another character in the show. Teddy Shapiro. That's all right. Shapiro Shapiro. I never knew that until I met him and then he corrected me. He and I go back to, I think I met him on Dodgeball.
Amazing.
And then we did a bunch of movies together over the years. And he's, I think, really brilliant composer, really amazing guy, just a great filmmaker, too. He sees every cut, you know, when Jeff and I will put a cut out to him. And I always, you know, get great feedback from him. So we started prepping the show, the first season, in like 2019. And then the pandemic hit 6 weeks before we were supposed to start shooting. And then we pushed like another 6 months, but continued working on the show. And he wrote a whole bunch of music in that time. So by the time we had started shooting the show, he had written the theme and the music before we'd shot a single scene. And then sometimes we'd play it on set in the first few weeks when we were shooting, just to give everybody a vibe of the feeling, which I think really helped the actors and helped me too, as we were sort of developing the tone of it. And then he's just so great in terms of being, he's really fast and he'll make adjustments and he writes suites. And like for episode 4, the Ortbo scene in the woods, he wrote a whole new theme for that. And then he'll give us these suites of music that then we'll edit in. And then when we have a locked cut, he'll then adjust and do things after that.
So great. And then the sound design as well, you know, even the kind of the lift beeps and the kind of hidden meaning behind all that.
Jacob Ribicoff and Mark Shafalis, who are in New York and work at Goldcrest Sound, and they've been on the show the whole time and they get every episode and they just dig into it. And, you know, there's so many. Yeah, sound is such an important part of any project, and they also have been with it the whole time. So there's this, you know, kind of same collaboration where they'll come up with ideas and things. And there's actually like a moment in this episode when with the Milchick and Egan comedy team thing, where it's like not going well. And like
that's
you hear like, and like we
way.
Were looking for some like canned sort of like, oh, you know, like hubbub, like, ooh, that's not good. And we couldn't find anything, right? So Jacob actually like recorded himself going like, ooh, that's not, ooh, I don't know about that. Yeah. So his voice is in there.
What is it like for you guys when you are kind of outside of Lumen filming, you know, whether it's the, you know, the away day or things like that, when you're kind of removed from that kind of environment in the real world, so to speak? Is it weird? Is it lovely? Is it, what is that like for you as a cast?
It's usually cold.
Great snowsuits, though.
Yeah.
I could not stop talking about how great pants are.
Adam, what's it like for you?
Yeah, it's fun. It's nice to get out of the office because we shoot on the stages where it's just all hallways, just hallways and hallways. And then in the center is the MDR office with the green carpet and everything. But the hallways are always being moved and shifted around in a maze-like fashion, depending on what's being shot. So when you're trying to get to the office where we're usually shooting, you literally get lost almost every time. And there have been many instances where I have to just stop and just yell that I'm here and I need someone to come find me because I don't know how to get to set. Yeah. And then you get there and it's fluorescent lights and the green carpet. And so when we get out every couple months, we get out to go shoot, like Ben was saying, we go shoot at the big building for a couple of weeks, or we go upstate and shoot some stuff. It's just nice to get out and breathe the fresh air and see the sky.
It's funny, when we were shooting the marching band thing, we discovered a new way into the bathroom. Because the bathroom, like at MDR, is like there, but like you have to take all the hallways to get there.
That's right.
But then, like, somebody discovered a shortcut, and I realized, like, the bathroom, like, you could get in the bathroom through a stall.
That's right.
Like, they took away one of the walls in the stall, and it was like right next to the entrance to the stage. And I was like, oh my God, we've been shooting this for 5 years, and this has been so close.
Game changer.
For 5 years,
game
and every changer. Time, right?
We went all the way around.
We got scooters. I mean, scooters.
Yeah. Then we finished the show in a week after that.
It's just right at the end.
All the walking time was cut down.
A couple more questions. The tone of the show is so... There's so many things that are unique about the show and the tone of it as well, because it kind of surprises you in terms of where one conversation might end. You think it's going one way and it kind of takes a slightly different tone towards the end of it. And that starts in the writing, Dan, but then I imagine that develops through shooting performances and editing as well. Does it shift a lot?
Yeah, I mean, I've always sort of been a fan of that mix of light and dark, going back to, you know, there's you know, stuff like Brazil or Monty Python, or like this movie LA Story that I love, where it's like you can go between something being really heartbreakingly earnest and sort of feels like it's in our world to suddenly going into a slightly different version of reality where the rules of logic are a little bit different. Mm. And, you know, we try to keep things a little bit more consistent on this show, but we have created our own kind of internal logic, especially on the Innie floor, because it's this insular world. And I've just always been drawn to that. And I was drawn to the willingness that Ben had to sort of expand beyond the normal bounds of genre and do something that was a little bit of a mix of flavors that we weren't necessarily used to and hadn't seen before.
Yeah. And I think one of the scenes I think that really kind of hits hard as well with that. I mean, there's a lot, you know, with Gemma and Mark's kind of story as well. But I think with Milchick, that moment where he's given the painting, you know, and that is kind of like, it's a really, really kind of powerful scene, and we kind of see a different side to him as a character, and not necessarily through dialogue but through your performance and your kind of reaction to that moment as well. Must be lovely as an actor to kind of, you know, if you think about that side of things and then the performance song and dance element to it in a well, and everything in between that this role gives you the opportunity to explore.
Yeah, no, it's complicated, you know. The painting scene was a big move on the part of the show. And, you know, I always feel that we were taking a risk by introducing the topic of race in this show and what it means specifically for Natalie and for Milchick and how we are going to carry that story forward. And what does that mean, you know, in the world of leadership? And how does Milchick respond to this moving? And, you know, as an actor, I'm inclined to think that everything that happens after episode 3, that moment where he gets those paintings, it shapes how he responds to every single circumstance. You know, I think that that's the moment of his awakening.
Yeah.
He's starting to see and learn.
Yeah, and it definitely informs that marching band scene.
I want to talk to you about the end of this season, you know, in terms of these two characters and the choice that Mark makes and the choice that she makes as well to kind of to be there to so that he kind of has to make a choice or decision. She's not asking him to, but her just being there kind of is a reminder that he has a choice to make sort of thing as well. I don't know what the question is really, but it's more, I guess, as an actor, when we see you guys running off, what's that kind of, what are you trying to convey? What's going through her head?
You know, she's just been standing on the try desk, remembering her friend Irving. And I think for everyone in MDR, they considered that a death. And so I think Helly runs to save her best friend. And lets him make that choice. But she goes from thinking he's about to step through that door and cease to exist to then he's alive. And maybe we have a fighting chance with this rebellion. And the last moment she sees on the other side of the hallway is Gemma. And I think she has this great empathy for what's happening and understanding that's a person who loves the same human that I love, just on the outside. And then running through the hallways, I think they're processing that together. And they're like wild horses, set free, but trapped.
Season 3, what's happening? Have you written anything? You're here, so the writer's room's not happening right
now. It's exactly right. We were in the writer's room.
Were you?
Yeah, we were. It's in LA. It's far away. but you shoot the show in New York, but Dan lives in LA. And yeah, it's been going for a few months. And, you know, we just have our process every time. And it's always a process, but we're in it. And there will be a season 3.
Yeah.
And
is it just like lots of post-it notes on the wall with kind of different colors for different characters? And
there's a lot of that. There's a lot of strings. There's a lot of just like weird scrawls on the, you know, scratch marks on the wall. There's something about a turtle, which actually I don't know. They put that up with when I wasn't there. What we're sort of trying to do is discuss this season and discuss where we want to go overall and make sure that what we end up telling is a very cohesive story. Mm-hmm. And so we've always been very meticulous about it and we continue to be, but we're having a real good time. I'll say that.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being here, but also just giving us something as, I think, you know, Gwendolyn, you were saying that, just something that's so unique, but that makes us think as an audience, you know, and you kind of see elements of yourself in different scenarios or people or situations. And it's just absolutely fantastic. So I can't wait for season 3. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you so much.
Huge round of applause for a wonderful band. If I can ask you guys just to stay in your seats just while we get everybody out, since we've got a huge panel, and then you guys can head to the bar and have some drinks. Thank you.
From the Score to Severance, that's Interdepartmental by Teddy Shapiro. Rounding off this first part of our Severance special, recorded at Everyman King's Cross. Now, obviously, music wasn't the focus of that slightly bonkers but brilliant and insightful session. But as I mentioned, I did also get to spend 10 minutes with Ben separately. So here's that chat preceded by another of Teddy's cues, Labour of Love. Specifically, I got to get his name right today. I felt really bad about getting Theodore's name wrong last night.
Shapiro. Very fancy.
It's very fancy. Yes, it's like a cake.
He's really, it's Theodore Shapiro. If you know him, he's Teddy. And if you know him really well, he's Teddy Shaps.
Oh, wow.
Teddy Shaps. Yeah.
I look forward to that moment.
Yeah.
For sure.
You should interview him sometime. He's amazing.
I'd love
to. He's the sweetest guy and a real genius, I think. The way he puts music together and like I said, as a filmmaker too.
Because I think when we last spoke about you as a director, Secret Life of Walter Mitty was way back. And so you brought him from that to this, basically.
I go back to Dodgeball with him. He did Dodgeball and then he did Tropic Thunder too.
Wow.
And he's done so many good movies, yeah.
What were the conversations about Severance and what you envisaged, you know, for the show?
You know, it's interesting, when you have a script that's really evocative and specific, I think, and you work with people who you have a relationship with, sometimes it's just about, you know, sending them the script and allowing them to kind of react to it and have their own take on it. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes you get the best stuff that way because, you know, he already had a vibe from reading it. And we talked a little bit about, you know, the way that I saw it and, you know, kind of the look of the show. And he came and visited the set when we were in pre-production. And I think that really helped him, too, to have a sense of what it was, you know, looking like. And then, you know, it's that thing when you collaborate with people, you want to allow them to bring their own ideas to it. And hopefully you're in sync, and usually if you're working with somebody that you've worked with before. So the great thing about him is he's really malleable and, you know, can do many different styles, and he just sort of ran with it, yeah.
That theme's extraordinary, and it's kind of, it's got as much kind of mystery as the show does almost within it. It can sort of almost like dance into different genres in a way.
Well,
it's so clever.
And he does that with it. I mean, he sent me a few different options for the theme.
Yeah.
And they were all interesting. But there was that one, the one that became the theme that really just resonated for me and just seemed like, it's like, wow, this is really kind of spooky and cool. And
it's romantic though as well at moments. It's all kind of like, it's got just so much, it's so simple almost. Quite hard to play on the piano. I've tried. But it's kind of just got... it's so clever.
Yeah, I don't know how he does it. I mean, I've watched him do it. Where he just sort of, you know, in his studio where he'll put the, you know, picture up and then he has like a keyboard and he'll just sort of play around. I've been there when he does it and it's pretty crazy. It's like
magic.
Watching somebody do something that you have no idea. Yeah, because he's dealing with so many different things, you know, as a composer you're dealing with. The tone, you're dealing with the emotion, you're dealing with
suspense and like understanding how to orchestrate instruments in a way that he knows what's going to give you a certain feeling of something, and he's always looking for new ways to voice the score and finding players that he works with or people who play instruments that are like a detuned piano and things like that that he'll bring in. So it's so much fun.
Everything that he creates has got to kind of, you know, it's got to live with all these, I mean, multiple needle drops that the show has, you know, right. In terms of, you know, and the clever way that pieces of music are kind of come in and out or reused, whether it's Billie Holiday, for example, you know, in terms of, or things might be manipulated, like the Motorhead track, you know, and that kind of thing as well.
Yeah.
It would take me a day to talk to you about all the pieces of music that are used in the show.
Yeah.
Where are those choices coming from? Are they from you? Are they from Dan? Are they a mixture of things?
I mean, I'd have to say, you know, I like to get into it pretty much in terms of music choices in the editing room with Jeff Richman, our editor, who's amazing with music, too, as an editor.
Yeah.
And I keep a playlist. You know, I start a playlist at the beginning of each project, any movie or show that I'm working on. And you just start to, like, you know, and George Draculius, who is our music supervisor, who I've, you know, known forever and worked with for a long time, too, he'll send playlists of ideas, and I start just building it on my music app. I'll just, like, you know, start building playlists and then get when it's, you know, gives you suggestions.
Yeah.
So I'll do that, and sometimes if I'm looking for a specific cue for... you know, a scene, I'll just start like, okay, like, you know, like the Burt retirement party in the first season, I'll just like make a playlist for that and try to find. And then you get maybe like, you know, 20 or 30 songs and something sticks in your head and then you play it against picture. And sometimes you just look at the picture, I'll go home and I'll just play different songs to it and see what feels right. And then you're thinking about the lyrics too.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's interesting. It's a fun process. Also, deciding when you should have needle drop music versus score.
Yeah.
And then Teddy is a real part of that too, because I'll send it to him, and I'll say, hey, I'm thinking about doing a song here. But sometimes he'll write a piece of music that he'll be like, yeah, maybe you should do a song here. I can't really think of something that works as well as what you had in the temp cut or something like that. Yeah.
And there's diegetic as well in that, whether it's like, you know, Petey and his daughter with the...
Enter Sandman.
Yeah, Enter Sandman as well. Or, you know, Choreography and Merriment. It's kind of all those... There's music as such a big part of the show.
Well, with the Choreography and Merriment scene, I told Teddy there was going to be a marching band. And I said, we're going to need, like, you know, some songs. And he was like... He's like, yeah, I got it. Don't worry, I got it. and literally, like, in a week, he sent, like, the temp, you know, his mock-ups of both those songs.
Yeah.
And, of course, he used the Kier hymn from the first season, which was awesome. And then he came up with this other song because we knew we'd need more music. And I was just, like, the way that he orchestrated it and then brought in real players, it was just incredible. We'll be right back.
you know that's going to be like played live at so many situations now as well.
Yeah.
That's
going to we had it at the Paley Center Festival. The at the end of the screening, the USC marching band came in.
Wow.
So, I love marching band music, and you know it's so it's just incredibly exciting when you hear it live.
Yeah.
And it was fun when we were shooting too, because those they were playing, they weren't playing live all the time, but they did play live in certain situations, and the drummers were drumming, and those drummers are just so incredible.
Random question. Mm-hmm. Do the innies and outies have the same music taste?
Well, I think that's an interesting thing. I mean, I think the innies aren't exposed to as much music as the outies, but I always love the question of what transcends the severance barrier, you know, which is like kind of one of the main themes of the show. And that idea of sort of subconscious, you know, I mean, it's in the like the Irving dream scene where, you know, he's we're hearing the Ace of Spades sort of in a weird sort of, you know, you know, crazy dreamlike version of it that Teddy came up with. I think that's interesting. So I think they probably do on a certain level, you know, relate to the same things, but they wouldn't know it. And that's the fun of it, too.
Yeah. You know, as a director and executive producer, you're not on camera in this, but if you could be, as an actor, be in the scene of any element of Severance, what would it be?
I don't know. I really have, like, stayed out of it. So, I mean, I'm not, like, saying that because, like, you know, it's just, like, I feel like I'm the show's great without me in it. But, you know, as an actor, it's fun to, like, think, oh, like, you know, wow, these actors are so good. It would be fun to be in it, but I don't want to be in it. Does that make sense? What I'm saying is I'm not angling to be in it because I don't want to be in it.
Yeah.
But it is, of course, you know, like, I guess I could see, like, somewhere like in the Lumen management, maybe, or something like that.
Yeah, calling the shots, basically,
yeah,
for
well,
sure.
Well, just being like, yeah, some like kind of pain in the butt boss or something, I don't know.
And has there been a most memorable location for you in terms of this, you know, because we have these incredible sets within the show, but then it's really kind of like, it's kind of like, oh, when you see that we're in a different environment and stuff. For you as a director, in terms of taking that world somewhere else, has been a memorable location for you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, one of the weirdest things we did, which was really fun, was for the Goat Room. We shot it on a golf course in Brooklyn, New York. So we went out to found a golf course, and then we built the walls around the golf course. So this was our Jeremy Hindle, our production designer's idea. He said there was no way we're going to be able to build the rolling hills inside because it's too expensive to do that. So let's just find real ones and then build the walls around it.
That's so
clever. So that was pretty wild.
Yeah.
That was fun. And then we had to kind of complete it with a computer, but I thought they did a great job of that. And then I love shooting in upstate New York. We shoot near Kingston, New York, shooting the Ortbo scenes up, you know, in episode 4 in the snow was a fun experience. But, like, for me, it's always, like, the set, you know, the hallways. I'll always feel like that's, like, the home of the show, you know.
Very much excited for season 3. Congratulations.
Thanks. Thank
great
you.
Chat
great
to you.
Talking to you again.
Are you still a fan of Smith & Burrows, by the way?
Yes.
My husband.
Really?
Smith, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Just tell him I said hi.
I will, yeah. We'll be right back. from Teddy Chaparro's score to Severance, that's still vibrating, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking about the hit show. My huge thanks to everybody who took the time to join us at King's Cross Everyman, to all of those at Everyman, the wonderful team at Everyman for continuing to support our exciting partnership. Also, the wonderful team at Apple TV Plus, and also DDA for really getting behind us with this particular event. It was phenomenal. Severance is available to watch now on Apple TV Plus, and you'd be mad to not get involved if you haven't already. So as you've gathered, it's not our first Everyman rodeo. So if you want to hear my interviews with the likes of Sofia Coppola, Jesse Eisenberg, Sam Taylor-Johnson, Will Ferrell and Harper Steele, and many, many more, just head to edithbowman.com. You can follow us on our socials. We're at Soundtracking UK. And please, please do subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is called Soundtracking Extra. Also, another little project that I'm working on at the minute is called Be In The Scene. Working with a friend of mine to kind of bring locations to life, but also take you further and deeper into the worlds of these wonderful films and TV shows. So if you aren't already across what we're doing with that, check us out on the socials or on the website, which is beinthescene.com, or on your socials at Be In The Scene. Next up, as I said, Kevin McDonald discusses his fantastic John and Yoko documentary, One to One. For details again on how you can see that this week at the IMAX pre-release, just head to 121film.com. But make sure you join me next week for my chat with Kevin. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
At Renewal by Andersen, we love sharing friendly words of wisdom about windows and doors. And we're thrilled when our customers do the same.
We're just so happy with the quality of the windows, the warranty of the windows, the fact that I get a call every year asking, is there anything else we can do for you? Do you need any help with anything? That to me is a good quality company.
Visit us online at iHeartMyWindows.com to schedule an in-home appointment when it's time to talk windows. We'll bring the wisdom. Renewal by Andersen.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.